Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This week's Groundwire was produced by Carly Forbes, CFRU, in Guelph, Ontario. In this edition, updates on the Musqueam struggle to protect Tsesnam, reflections on the recent ruling to strike down the ban on assisted suicide, and the preservation of the Tsuut'ina language. But first, here's a headline about the racist opportunism in the aftermath of a recent shooting in Scarborough.
I'm Mary-Carl Giao in Guelph, reporting for Groundwire. On Monday the 16th of July is when a backyard party on Danzig Street in Scarborough, Ontario, got out of hand. The incident resulted in two deaths and over 20 being injured, including a 22-month-old child. The two young individuals who died in the incident were 14-year-old Cheyenne Charles and 23-year-old Joshua Yasse, but investigators believe they were not the intended victims. But despite the horrors witnessed by local communities and their desire to return to normal, Canadian politicians are using the events as a platform to spew anti-immigrant comments and hatred. Toronto Mayor Rob Ford, in particular, jumped into the spotlight shortly after the news broke and said, quote, "I don't care if you're an immigrant or not. If you get caught with a gun, I want to find out the legalities of are you allowed to stay here or are you not? I'm sure it falls under some sort of immigration law." Before any charges or arrests had been made, the focus of political commentary was on the role immigrants played in this unfortunate scene. Such events are seen by politicians like Ford as an opportunity to promote anti-immigrant laws and rhetoric. This is a growing and long-standing trend in Canada. The linking of crime to immigration. Well, certain crimes, that is. Through media interviews and legislation like Bill C-43, the Canadian government is trying hard to associate gun violence with immigration and address the issue by physically removing from the country those they suspect to be involved, most especially if they are immigrants. Mayor Rob Ford also wants social programming to be cut, calling it, quote-unquote, hug-a-thug funding, and declaring that such investments bring few returns. These remarks do little to bridge the gap between City Hall and marginalized people of color and immigrant communities. Ford appears to have little interest in actually resolving disputes. More police on the streets and deportations are being touted by him and his colleagues as the only solutions worth considering, with a total disregard for the contributions made by community groups, religious organizations, counselors, sports teams, or any number of other social programs that are already in place for Danzig residents. The contributions made at the community level by social and support groups foster increased chances to dispute resolution, better understanding of the other's position, and a more regenerative healing process. The Toronto police budget is already over $1 billion annually and includes funding for programs such as the well-funded Toronto Anti-Violence Intervention Strategy that are offered to supposedly address gang activity. But the mindset of participants must be pro-police, and funding is cut from groups that do not fully support the mantra of more police and more arrests leads to, quote-unquote, safer streets. Discussions of police brutality or support for groups that have been targeted by police are a sure ticket to be removed from the Toronto Anti-Violence Intervention Strategy funding block. It is the root causes like widespread poverty, racism, a largely irrelevant education system, misdiagnosed or diagnosed mental health, and a grave lack of social services within our communities that needs to be addressed by our political leaders instead of strengthening the pipeline from streets to prison that Ford and others are fond of.
In a joint public statement from Toronto-based Filipino and Latino community organizations concerning events in the wake of the Danzig Street shootings, Pablo Vivanco of Barrio Nuevo raised this point, quote, "We also need to start asking where these guns are coming from, who is bringing them into this city, and why. These youth are not making or smuggling guns, so we need to acknowledge that there are bigger things at play and target the real players in this morbid game." For people like Prime Minister Stephen Harper and Toronto Mayor Rob Ford, it is easier to point the finger of blame on young people from a marginalized community instead of looking more closely at biker gangs or larger elements within organized crime that actually import these guns into the country.
The July 16th bloodshed is what made the news, but arguably, the bigger criminals are the ones who profited from the event and continue to evade both charges and public scrutiny.
The real disservice to our communities is when our elected leaders make opportunistic statements that both distract from and ignore the more severe problems like the heavy crime of gun running and propagate the offloading of blame on disempowered and disengaged communities and voices.
I'm Mary Carl Giao reporting in Guelph for Groundwire.
Now it's time for Groundwire's Community Radio Report, produced by Shelley Robinson.
Because wherever you are, it's only be, 19 minutes past 4 o'clock. We will until 5 o'clock. My name is Douglas Tulin and Michelle right here. Have a Thursday from 3 to 5 o'clock.
So I met Delroy as a volunteer because I started at CHRY as a volunteer. In this space, he is very much jovial and above the rim in terms of happiness. And on one occasion, I took info to the studio during his show. And he sent somebody and said, she needs to come in. And she needs to say that on air. And it started from there. We became friends as well as co-hosts and all that kind of stuff.
Always a friend, always a friend. Folks, don't forget, coming up at 5 o'clock, we get news with the crew. And with us, let's say thank you so much for touching base. Well, let's say good afternoon and thank you, Mr. Ramdan's master, father the greatest, of course, inside the studio. Rich Kid International, respect. Thank you for the link in the lady saw. Action, big up yourself. You don't know, you're the champion for life, and life is always with you.
He was definitely one of those individuals in the space that was very welcoming and open. He would be very open to women in the space. And his show was one of the shows where a lot of women got a chance to not just sit in, but also tech. I was a host for his show on many occasions. And other females that have come through the CHRY space can say they started there and then they went on to get their own shows or so on.
Classic reggae rock inside 105.5, 12 minutes past 4 o'clock, you know what I'm saying? Classic Mix Supreme.
His show was a reggae show. It was called Mix Supreme, and the format was really, as the name suggests, a mixture of reggae. But his real interest would have been rockers and vintage reggae. So his show had a lot of lovers rock, a lot of, you know, the Barris Hammonds and the Dennis Browns and the Gregory Isaacs. And then his show was also welcoming to Canadian talent. So there were a number of artists that, as they would say in the reggae scene, that bus on his show.
I want to say to the massive, don't forget about the Reggae Music Achievement Award taking place June the 10th at Club Paradise featuring Lady Jade, Anthony Malva, special guest Steel, the Mystic, Juno Jazz, and also the brother man called Mr. Keith Poppin that give you same thing for breakfast, same thing for dinner. That's June the 10th at Club Paradise, the Reggae Music Achievement Awards.
For Delroy, I think what he wanted was just to have a space where he could unwind, have fun, and make those connections with people. And there are a number of people who, through his loss, we've seen come to the hospital to visit or come to visitations and so on. And they're all a lot of listeners. And they just had this kind of connection to him. And so as an ambassador for CHRY, he definitely had that connection to people and connection to community.
I just want to remind us of a great radio man who passed away.
Yes.
And,
yeah.
I'm going to miss him.
Yeah, definitely.
Leroy Sterling.
Mr. Sterling. Yeah, man, trust me.
It's important, like I said, you know, to have a voice. He made a difference.
Yes.
Big things.
CHRY got together and they put on an amazing tribute
Memorial
with the Mountain Edge Band and EOP Band, yeah, Tanya Mullins, Steel, Tony Anthony. There were so many artists that came out. Luther Brown, with pride, said the doors have been closed. Mm-hmm. They've maxed the capacity in JCA, which we've never seen done before.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, Delroy
was amazing.
Delroy was an amazing man.
We're gonna miss him, you know. Zoom gone, but it's not forgotten, you know.
All right, most definitely.
Yeah.
He really was electrifying in the space. Always dancing during his show, you know, he was having fun with the music because he really, really loved the music. Just having that avenue, I think, in retrospect, he would have said he got a lot.
In our first feature, Gennarty O'Sullivan and Woody Morrison spoke with Cecilia Point, a spokesperson for the Musqueam people currently protecting their ancestors' ancient burial site from being developed into condos.
And now we have our friend, her name is Cecilia Point. She's the spokesperson for the Musqueam Midden. It's based at the foot of Marpole, and it's based at the foot of the Arthur Lang Bridge. There has been a protest site there for over 60 days. A lot of things have happened. They've been trying to negotiate with the province. The city is on their side, as well as the developer, in doing a sort of like a land swap deal. But the province was unable to make a decision. They brought in a negotiator. The negotiator, they couldn't come up with anything on their own. So now they're dealing at a different level with the owner. So Cecilia is here to give us the update. Hello, Cecilia.
Hi, Gennarty. How are you?
I'm good. We got a full house. Everybody that is in the studio are major supporters of the Musqueam protest.
That's fantastic. And I also wanted to introduce you to Rhiannon Bennett, another Musqueam member. She's here with me. And whenever you can't reach me, Rhiannon will also do media inquiries.
Good afternoon.
Hi there. How are you?
Doing well, thank you.
Nice to hear from you. So the both of you are involved in this new phase of negotiations?
Yes, yeah.
So
so we're not at the negotiating table, but we're here at the protest site, you know, and we're keeping watch of the construction site.
And how has that been going so far?
The latest update is that we are now in direct negotiations with Century Group, and I guess the new company is called Century Holdings, and so they're a combination of the Hackett family's business, LandPro, and Century Group, so they formed this company that now owns the property. So the band is negotiating directly with them to purchase this property.
I understand that the construction companies, everybody was there, packed up their tools and went home.
Well, not all of them. They've packed up some of their equipment and taken some things out of the office here. They moved their first aid trailer away and so on.
And also the owner, Mr. Hackett, he has a daughter who has been coming around the site and acting up a storm over there. Tell us more about that.
Well, she came one day last week, and as you know, we have a legally appointed monitor who is allowed to be on the site. So, like I said, the construction crew was coming and picking up some items. So our monitor was on the site making sure that, you know, they're not removing boxes that have our ancestors' bones in them and artifacts and so on. So our monitor was there, and Yes, the young lady came, and I guess she gave them an envelope. I don't know what for, but she had to have some interaction with the construction crew or the movers. And she kicked our monitor off of the site and told him he's not allowed to be on there. And I told her, you know, that yes, someone can come from the band office right now with a letter telling you that we are allowed to have a monitor outside the site. And she yelled at us and said we were only allowed outside the fence and that she was going to call the police. I said to her, please call the police and we will show them this letter and, you know, indicating that we're allowed to have one monitor inside the fence. But she just kept yelling at us. And there was a gentleman with her who I've since learned is her business partner. And he yelled at us, you know, that this is private property and we're not allowed on it. And he actually even yelled at us, why didn't you do something about this 52 years ago? It was also upsetting that they decided to come on the day that Wayne's mother's funeral was taking place.
That's right. Rose Point just passed away a while ago, and as a result, the people at the Musqueam site all came to be in support of the family. Most of the people from the site went there. So at that point, you were vulnerable, and that is when the owner decided to make his little moves on the site, right?
Right, and the last day they came before that was Aboriginal Day, where, again, all the community was up at our band, you know.
Well, Cecilia, I'd just like to point out that that isn't uncommon. The people that were building the Enbridge pipeline and proposed to build it on the Wet'suwet'en territory, the Wet'suwet'en people had somewhat, like, they had the same problem. One of the elders from their community passed away. They were at the services, and while they were at the service, Enbridge was trying to lay down the pipeline and the equipment to start drilling. And so one of the young people from that territory had to leave the service and set up a blockade, and that's how that all started, you know. And then there was this division caused from the people who were treaty and anti-treaty and all of that. So it's not an unknown tactic, just as earlier when Woody was saying that they take our children away to make us more vulnerable and do whatever it is that they want us to do.
And now it's time for a short musical break.
Mere sight of naked fear choked every limb. Young man, what is your name? Young man, what is your name? The human heart will refrain, it is all the same. Fire away, heavy hands, fire away. She did not speak of it. In the morning she slept with good faith. Oh no, I have changed. Oh no,
by Cold Specs, who performed at Hillside Festival in Guelph recently. Now for an interview with Bruce Starlight about the preservation of the Tsut Inhagana language.
That's Bruce Starlight, the director of the Tsut Inhagana Institute. The institute is dedicated to the study and preservation of the Tsut Ina language. It's located on the Tsut Ina Reserve on the southwest edge of the city of Calgary. The language is recognized as being one of the most critically endangered in the country, with just 51 fluent speakers who are all elders. Here's a little more from Bruce.
We've been doing language since 1972, and we really haven't made any progress. And I think if you went to most of the communities, they'll tell you the same thing. We haven't produced speakers right across Canada. If they have, they've been very lucky and they have a very unique approach. And that's what we're trying to create here. And a lot of other communities can, you know, where they have a large speaker base, they can go to immersion, but we don't have that luxury. Because the youngest speaker is 64 years old. So we're an extinct language, according to the rules of the linguistic community. So we are in a crisis situation with our languages, and we need to begin to talk to one another.
Starlight, who grew up speaking the Sut'ina language within his family, believes that it is important to understand fundamental differences between Aboriginal languages like Sut'ina and colonial languages like English.
I'm not a teacher. My background is linguistics. But, you know, I see the problem all over. You know, there's no retention. There's no, there's words. In this community, maybe there's 1,000 words out there. But, you know, the language is made up of about 10 million words. And it's very unlike English. English has, it's finite. But our languages continue to grow. They continue to change. Because that's who we are. That's the resilience of our people as First Nations. We're always, how you say, we're always in flux. We're always ready to change. And so that's the nature of our languages, that it changes. And it accepts and it creates the, the room to accept other foreign influences, not so much the language. Our language, we've been among the Blackfoot for 400 years. We've been with a white man for 200 years. We haven't bought any words. One of the comments I just heard recently was that I'm a speaker. I'm immersed in the language. I was inundated. I was immersed in the language. He said, today, he said, these people that are learning my language, they know it, but they don't know about it, and they didn't live the language.
The Sut'ina Gunaha Institute is planning a language conference for spring of 2013, and Bruce Starlight hopes to work with members of other First Nations to find strategies to better teach Aboriginal languages in communities with few fluent speakers, like Sut'ina, where most kids hear only English at home.
This old lady told me, "Dikana sahiste." That's what she said. That means, don't be writing it down. Our languages are holy. And then, you know, that was before I went back to school. And then when I went back to university, I began to see what this old lady was saying. What I realized was the ability to change. It's not there because you wrote it down. You look at English, you look at French, you look at German. That's it. What is written is it. Because a white man and our children, that's what they know. Because for all intents and purposes, we've become white. You know, and because everything, you know, our dress, our demeanor, our anger, it's all foreign to us. When I was growing up, it wasn't like that.
Although he's been working on this for a long time, Starlight believes that the pieces needed are there.
See, our scholars died off during the epidemics. All our astronomers, all our scientists died here. And we had nothing. That's why it appeared to the white men we had nothing. But we lost it through our scientists. And there is a lot of knowledge yet among our people, but it's just coming back. You know, it's coming back in bits and pieces. But if you gather all what's remaining from all the Aboriginal people, you'll find that the whole story of the universe has some here, some there, some there.
This is Catherine Fisher from Kootenai Co-op Radio, reporting for Groundwire.
And now, a feature from AMI Audio's interview program, Contact, regarding a historic court decision on a controversial issue. Jason Vermesh of AMI Audio reports.
On June 15th, this country's ban on assisted suicide was struck down by the BC Supreme Court. Madam Justice Lynn Smith ruled the criminal code provisions, quote, unjustifiably infringe the equality rights of people with disabilities. The ruling affects Gloria Taylor, who suffers from ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease, as well as two other plaintiffs, Lee Carter and her husband Hollis Johnson. Carter and Johnson joined the landmark legal challenge on behalf of Lee's elderly mother, Kay Carter, whom they helped obtain a legal assisted suicide in Switzerland. Nearly two decades ago, the Supreme Court of Canada ruled against medically assisted suicide. Yet, this kind of procedure is permitted in Switzerland, Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and the state of Oregon. Justice Smith allowed the BC decision to be suspended for 1 year, allowing Parliament to respond. Earlier this month, the federal government announced it would appeal the BC court ruling. This issue has raised the concerns of certain groups like the Council of Canadians with Disabilities and Euthanasia Prevention Coalition, who have stated the lives of people with disabilities are more vulnerable as a result of this decision. Amy Hasbrook of the disability organization Not Dead Yet says she believes the decision is actually discriminatory.
It is simply not illegal to kill oneself, but there is no right to take one's life. And in fact, we have a public policy against suicide. We spend an awful lot of money to try to prevent people from killing themselves. If someone says that they want to kill themselves, they could be incarcerated in a psychiatric hospital against their will for fear that they might hurt themselves. The problem is that when these standards are applied disparately in a uneven manner. So if a person without a disability says, I feel really miserable, my life is terrible, I want to end it all, that person is given suicide prevention treatment, steered toward mental health counseling, potentially even incarcerated to prevent him or her from killing himself. On the other hand, if a person with a disability says the same thing, my life is miserable, I don't want to go on anymore, that person is encouraged to kill him or herself. And in addition, it's not just that that person is encouraged, but the person is assisted. In general, the statistics on suicide are that approximately 90% of suicide attempts fail because, as we know, that they're often a cry for help. Well, the same thing can be true for people with disabilities. But if we have the state stepping in and saying this person's suicide should succeed, then we have a person, a doctor, coming in and making that suicide attempt succeed, whereas the suicide attempt of a non-disabled person might not. So that's a double standard that we feel is very inappropriate and discriminatory. But we're saying that the double standard that's applied to the suicides of people with disabilities is the discriminatory problem.
Grace Pastine, litigation director with the BC Civil Liberties Association, who is involved in bringing the case to the BC Supreme Court, disagrees.
This is one thing that really changed between when Sue Rodriguez brought her case before the Supreme Court of Canada and when Gloria Taylor brought her case before the court. In those intervening 20 years, a number of jurisdictions began to allow for medically assisted dying for the terminally ill or for the seriously and incurably ill. And a lot of research was done on those jurisdictions. Oregon's Death with Dignity legislation has been called the most studied piece of legislation in the world. It's been very closely studied by very prominent scholars. Some of these scholars and researchers gave evidence before Madam Justice Smith. What this research shows is that fears about medically assisted dying are unfounded. I mean, certainly it is extremely important that there be safeguards in place. But once those safeguards are in place, what the evidence shows is that medically assisted dying upholds choice, it prevents suffering, it upholds human rights.
Pastine expects the matter to be ultimately decided by the Supreme Court of Canada. To hear these interviews in their entirety, please visit AMI at ami.ca and follow the contact link on the homepage. This is Jason Vermesh of AMI Audio reporting to Groundwire.
That's it for this week's edition of Groundwire. Music this week was by Cold Specs from Etobicoke, Ontario. Thank you to Gennarji O'Sullivan, Woody Morrison, Mary Carl Giao, Catherine Fisher, Paul Daniel, Jason Vermesh, and Leanne Arneson. Groundwire is a project of the NCRA.